Okay. Some people use the term animal rights to refer simply to the moral claims of non-human animals, whatever those might be. But in this paper, I'm using the term rights in its more specific sense to designate a certain kind of moral claim. A right is a moral claim that may be and indeed ought to be legally enforced. Its enforcement is a matter of justice, not merely a matter of humanity or kindness. Now, I think that most people think that animals have moral standing, as I've argued for the last 2 days, even if many people wouldn't agree with the reasons that I've given. That is, most people think that animals are the appropriate objects of moral concern. They think that we have duties of humanity or kindness to animals. Most people also think that at least some of these duties should be supported by legal sanctions. That's why there are animal welfare protection laws on the books. Yet for reasons that I'll mention in a moment, many people think it is absurd to suppose that animals have rights in the specific sense I just mentioned. Now, in this paper, I'm going to argue that animals do have rights, but of a different structure than most rights. Most rights are held against individuals, either against every individual in a group, as when civil rights are, or against some specific individuals, as when two people are bound by a contract or a promise. Animals, I'm going to argue, have rights that are in the first instance rights against humanity collectively speaking, that is, humanity considered as a group, and their rights to be treated in ways that are consistent with their good. I'm going to argue that there are such rights, rights against humanity collectively speaking, by arguing that every human being who is in need of aid has, in order to survive, has a right with exactly this structure, a right against humanity collectively to that aid. Both that particular human right and animal rights are traceable to the same fact, namely that humanity, collectively speaking, is in a position to exercise extensive control over the fate of all the inhabitants of the planet with whom we interact. Okay, so what's supposed to be the problem with the idea of animal rights? I think there are three main objections to the idea. First, many people think that the realm of rights is a realm of reciprocity in some distinctive way. Rights are something we accord reciprocally to each other, and therefore to say that you have a right implies that you have obligations. It's a little difficult to pin down this thought in exactly the right way. For instance, we might be tempted to think of it as something like a bargain. I'll keep my hands off of your property and your liberties if you'll keep your hands off of mine. But making that kind of a bargain could simply be a matter of self-interest, and actually respecting the rights of others goes beyond that. Having rights, as we often tell the children when they claim them, goes along with having responsibilities or obligations. You can't have one without the other, so many people think. But non-human animals, or so I shall suppose, are not moral beings and cannot have obligations. So we might suppose that they can't have rights. Now, a second and related problem is that some theorists, especially those working in the natural rights tradition, believe that the special point of rights, as opposed to other kinds of moral claims, is to secure the liberty and autonomy of those who hold the rights. Immanuel Kant, for example, thought of rights as coercively enforceable prescriptions that are essential to maintaining the equal freedom of everyone. The use of force or coercion against free rational beings, he argued, is wrong except when you're using force to protect someone's freedom, to hinder a hindrance to freedom, as he liked to say. So we may use force or coercion, that is, we may use the power of the law in order to protect liberty, but not to promote other good ends. John Rawls, to take another example, thought of rights in a liberal society as aimed at securing to each citizen, as far as possible, the ability to pursue her own conception of the good. That is, her own conception of what's worth doing and caring about in a human life. Our rights ensure that we are not bound by restrictions governed merely in other people's ideas about what's worth doing and caring for. We are only bound by restrictions that spring from the requirement that everyone should have the ability to live against her, to live according to her own values. That should always be equally protected. But there's no point in trying to secure this kind of political liberty or autonomy to the other animals. They live according to their natures, not according to their values, or their free choices, or their personal conceptions of the good. Nor is there much to be said for granting them the nearest analog to this kind of liberty, freedom of action in the simplest sense, allowing them to go where they please and do whatever they want. When animals, either wild or domestic, live within the confines of human society, it's essential both for their safety and ours that they live under a certain degree of human control. So on this showing, rights don't seem to be the sort of thing that we could intelligibly grant to the other animals. Rights protect a kind of liberty that the other animals could not possibly have. Most importantly, however, the idea of animal rights seems worrisome to people because of its practical implications. Are all animals going to be accorded a basic right to life? And if so, are meat eating and hunting going to be disallowed? Would experiments on animals have to be brought to an end or limited to those that don't harm the animals? And what about those of our own activities that inevitably hurt or kill animals, even when the purpose of those activities is benign? We kill mice and rabbits when we drive tractors through the fields on which we grow our vegetables. We kill and injure birds when we put up wind turbines, or for that matter, when we put up windows and power lines. Whenever we use pesticides, we kill not only their targets, but other animals as well. Should all such activities be illegal or legally regulated in some way? These are controversial questions, and I think that under any reasonable conception of animal rights, the answer to some of them will be yes. I'm claiming in this paper that the idea of animal rights can be made to seem reasonable, conceptually speaking. I'm not claiming that it can be made to seem uncontroversial. But the questions I've just raised lead naturally to other questions that do begin to make the idea of animal rights seem unreasonable or even silly. If animals have a right to life, for instance, might people be prosecuted for killing vermin that are infesting their homes or their food supplies, or for swatting mosquitoes that are trying to bite them? And if animals have rights to life or rights not to have suffering inflicted upon them, ought we to interfere between predators and their prey in the name of protecting the rights of prey animals to escape this form of suffering and death? And must we then find adequate meat substitutes for the predators? Or should we actually try to eliminate predator species altogether, as Jeff McMahon suggested in a New York Times editorial a few years ago? There are obvious reasons, based on past experience, to worry about the human competence for tinkering with nature on this kind of scale. But even leaving those worries aside, many people find the idea of our managing nature in this way deeply distasteful, although the reasons are a little obscure. Some of us don't like the idea of living in a completely domesticated world. Some people feel that it's not part of humanity's business to try to moralize nature, or even that we don't have the right to. These worries give rise to some rather deep questions about what the human place in nature is and how we should think about and respond to the amoral character of nature itself. For all of these reasons, many people think that we have duties of kindness and humanity to animals, but that the claims animals have on us don't arise from any rights on the part of the animals themselves. Now, before I examine this claim, I want to clarify something about the conception of rights that I'm working with that's going to be important to my case. So far, what I've said has been ambiguous between two claims, that animals should have rights or that they do have rights. There's a reason for this ambiguity because there's a problem about what's going on when someone makes the case for a legal right. Saying that I'm arguing that animals should have rights has the disadvantage of making it sound as if all I'm saying is that there's something to be said in favor of their having rights, some reasons that would support the policy of giving them rights. But that might not seem like the correct way to argue for a right, since a right ordinarily functions as a trump, and a trump requires something stronger than some considerations in its favor. If I have a right to something, call it X, then you have no right to deprive me of X. My right is supposed to be a decisive consideration against your depriving me of X, however good your reasons for depriving me of X would be if I didn't have the right. So to say that I have a right to X is not just to say that there's a very strong reason for me to have X. It's to say something about the relations in which I stand to those against whom I claim the right. However good other people's reasons are for depriving me of X, they'll be wronging me if they do so. And that includes my relations to society, collectively speaking. But if my right is a trump, even against society, collectively speaking, then how can society, collectively speaking, be in a position to grant me the right? When someone claims she has a right, she's claiming precisely that no one is in a position to deny her that to which she has the right. But if no one's in a position to deny her the right, then it seems as if no one's in a position to grant her the right either. What she's saying is precisely that this is not the sort of thing that others may withhold or grant, however good their reasons. Consider, for instance, the idea that a nation might give its slaves a right to their freedom. Is another human being's right to his freedom something that it's ours to give? But how can society give someone its freedom if it's already his by right? Now, some philosophers try to deal with this problem by invoking the idea of a moral right, a right you should have, and saying that moral rights are the grounds on which we should establish legal rights. That enables them to split the difference. The moral rights do already exist, although the legal ones don't. Then we can say that what society does when it enacts laws protecting people's rights is not granting them rights they didn't already have, but protecting their moral rights by making them legal and so coercively enforceable. That can sound sensible until we remind ourselves what exactly a right is. A right, at least according to Kant and others in the natural rights tradition, is by definition a claim that may legitimately be coercively enforced. You have a right when you have a claim on others to act in a certain way, and it is morally legitimate for you or society on your behalf to defend yourself with the use of force against violations of that claim. Not all moral claims, we believe, may be coercively enforced. I can't sue you for hurting my feelings or being rude to me, or have you thrown into prison for breaking my heart, although you shouldn't do these things. I can't have you arrested if you fail to open a door for me when my arms are full of packages, or to help me change a tire by the side of the road. How do we draw the distinction? Some philosophers would argue that the distinction should be drawn on pragmatic or consequentialist grounds, and whether the costs of coercive enforcement are worth preventing wrongs of this kind. Kant, however, believed that the distinction is based on principle, and we've already seen what the principle is. We may coercively enforce a claim only when we are hindering a hindrance to freedom. That is, only when we're doing it to protect someone's freedom. According to Kant, I'm free when I can pursue my own ends, and in doing so, I am not subject to the wills of other people. I'm not made subject to your will when you try to break my heart, for I'm perfectly free not to care. I'm not made subject to your will when you fail to open a door for me, because that doesn't actually stop me from going through the door. But I am made subject to your will when you enslave me or make use of my person or my property without my consent. So my claims against doing those things are coercively enforceable. They're claims of right. This account of what makes a moral claim one of right makes trouble for the proposed use of the distinction between moral and legal rights. Because it follows from this account that if there are any rights, there's a sense in which they already have the status of law. That is, they may legitimately be coercively enforced. This, after all, is why we think it can sometimes be morally legitimate for people to fight even their own governments for their freedom, because they have a coercively enforceable right to that freedom, even if there is no positive law upholding it. On this view, natural right is underwritten by natural law. Indeed, they're almost the same thing. So the state cannot be seen as making it possible to coercively enforce a claim that is already there, since the claim was not only already there, but already coercively enforceable too. Now, this may not seem like a big problem, because of course there's still a question about the relation between law in this natural sense and the positive statutes that are actually passed by some political society. So why shouldn't we say that a state that makes a law establishing a right is simply acknowledging a natural right that's already there by making its own laws match the natural laws? But there's a problem with this too, which was brought out first by the philosopher Thomas Hobbes and then following him, Kant. They pointed out that there's a sense in which rights do not exist even morally until laws upholding them are enacted by political society. After all, to say that a right exists morally is not only to imply that you're entitled to enforce, to defend your claim with force, it's also to imply that people have a moral obligation to respect your claim. But Kant and Hobbes argued that no one can be morally obligated to respect my rights until he has some guarantee that I will respect his. For if I force you to respect my rights without giving you a guarantee that I will respect yours, then I'm putting you in a position where you're subject to my will, and so not free. As Hobbes wrote, a person who respects the rights of others when they do not respect his would but make himself a prey to others and procure his own ruin. Hobbes and Kant argued that it follows that no one has a duty to respect anyone else's rights until some mechanism of enforcing everyone's rights is in place. Since a right involves a duty on the part of others to uphold the right, and others can't have that duty unless their rights are upheld as well, rights occupy what we might call interpersonal space. My rights and yours can only be realized together. Notice that this explains one of the intuitions about rights that I mentioned earlier, that there's something essentially reciprocal about rights. Rights are reciprocal in the sense that the existence of my rights depends upon the existence of the rights of others. It follows that whenever you claim a right, you commit yourself to respecting the rights of others. Now, Kant argued that it's only in the political state that can provide guarantees of the enforcement of everyone's rights. So if I say, I have a right to X, I make a demand on others that I am not in a position to make unless we live together in a political state. Claims of right presuppose the existence of the political state. That is to say, they presuppose our membership in a collective body devoted to upholding the rights of everyone. Claims of right presuppose this, Kant thought, even if we're in the state of nature and the political state exists only in idea. So when I claim a right in the state of nature, I commit myself to supporting the existence of the political state. According to Kant, this means we have a duty to live in the political state. Our rights in the state of nature are, as Kant put it, provisional. They exist in the sense that we have the right to defend them, but not in the sense that anyone else has a duty to respect them. It's only when the state is actually formed that they become, again, as Kant put it, conclusive. Now, I think that Kant's distinction between provisional and conclusive rights explains the status of rights much better than the distinction between moral and legal rights does. Provisional rights are, in one sense, already legal, since the right holder is morally entitled to coercively enforce them. In another sense, however, they're not yet quite moral, since no one's obligated to respect them. What society does when it legalizes a right is neither to grant the right holder something that's already his own and not society's to give, nor to acknowledge a merely moral right that's already there by making it enforceable. What society does instead is to realize a right whose existence is essentially incomplete or imperfect in the state of nature. Okay, now with that conception of natural rights in view, I now want to ask exactly what the difference is between saying that human beings owe a moral duty of humanity or kindness to the other animals, and saying that animals have a right, that is a natural right in the sense I've just defined, to be treated in ways that are compatible with their good. Well, the tradition of moral philosophy supplies us with one fairly standard way of thinking about this difference in terms of the distinction between perfect and imperfect duties. As the distinction is normally understood, it goes something like this. A perfect duty is a duty to do some particular action. It's what's nowadays called a directed duty, meaning that it's owed to someone in particular who is wronged by its omission. A standard example of a perfect duty is the kind of obligation we incur through an act of our own, like making a promise. If I make you a promise, I owe you the act that I promised you I would perform, and I wrong you if I fail to perform it. The duties of justice are generally considered perfect duties. Here, what's required is often omission rather than action. If you violate one of my rights, you have wronged me by performing an act which you ought to have omitted. We have an imperfect duty, on the other hand, when we're obligated to do some general kind of action, but the duty isn't specific about exactly which actions we should do, and it's not owed to anyone in particular. Many of us think of our duties of charity as taking roughly this form. We ought, we feel, to do something for those less well off than ourselves, but it's entirely up to us what form the giving takes and to whom exactly we will give. You can give volunteer time if you don't have much money, or money if you don't have time. You can give to Oxfam or the Red Cross, or you can microfinance would-be entrepreneurs in third world countries. Or you can give spare change to homeless people sleeping in doorways on the street. All of that is entirely up to you. But no homeless person or would-be entrepreneur in a third world country has a particular claim on you. No such person is entitled to feel wronged or to drag you into court if you choose not to give to him. Imperfect duties, in short, do not correspond to rights. Now, the picture that results from this traditional distinction is, I think, a familiar one. There's a realm of justice in which we can make claims on each other. If those claims are not met, someone has been wronged. The duties of justice serve mainly to protect our freedom and autonomy and the rights in which those are embodied. But a good person, a well-motivated person, will go beyond meeting the demands of justice. She will want to promote the good of others as well as to respect their rights, and so will engage in acts of charity, kindness, and beneficence. These actions cannot be required of us by law, but a good person will want to do them. It is into this category, according to the traditional story, that the morality of both kindness to animals and charity to strangers falls. And this is the picture that I wish to challenge. And I'm not alone. Nowadays, many people would call this story into question. An obvious worry concerns the duties of rescue. If you're driving down a deserted road and encounter someone who's been injured in a car accident, your duty to help him seems to be a duty of beneficence. You are concerned with promoting his good, not with protecting his freedom. But you don't seem to have the discretion that's supposedly associated with the imperfect duties of beneficence. You cannot just choose either to help or not as you please, in the way you can supposedly choose to give to a particular homeless person on the street or not as you please. Of course, if stopping would put you in some sort of danger, or if you are even now rushing someone else to the hospital, then we might think you do nothing wrong in not stopping to help. But short of that, it seems as if you owe it to the injured person to stop and as if you've wronged him if you just drive on by. So there seems to be a required action and a specific person who will be wronged if you don't do it. The characteristics of a perfect duty. Now, we might try to argue that the duties of rescue, unlike ordinary duties of beneficence or charity, simply are perfect duties. But Peter Singer has famously pointed out that our duties of charity to distant strangers often have the same features as the duties of rescue. There are people in third world countries in conditions of famine or extreme poverty who are dying as we speak. Assuming there is simply not enough charity already on offer to cover all the need, a small donation, not costly to you, could make the difference of life and death to one of these people. It's not clear which one, of course, so there's no particular person who can accuse you of wronging him if you don't make the donation. In that sense, it looks like a case of imperfect duties. But in other ways, it looks just like the more local case of rescue. Someone will die or be harmed if you don't act, and that seems to make it a perfect duty. Now, this suggests, I think, that there's something wrong with the distinction between perfect and imperfect duties. To see this, imagine a reasonably affluent society in which people are entirely well-motivated. They're good, genuinely charitable people. If it were really true that it's entirely a matter of discretion to whom each person gives and exactly when and how, then someone could starve or die of an injury in their midst without anyone doing anything wrong, simply because no one happened to choose him as the object of their charity. Faced with this sort of problem, I think we should take a look at a different possible way of understanding the duties of beneficence. Not in terms of the idea that benefactors have an imperfect duty, but instead in terms of the idea that those in need of sustenance or care have an imperfect right. The early modern philosophers who introduced this category into moral thinking often write as if an imperfect right is just the right correlative to an imperfect duty. But in fact, it matters a great deal which of these ideas we start with. Suppose we take the fundamental fact here to be that each of us individually has an imperfect duty to help others. It's not owed to anyone in particular. Is it owed to anyone at all? There seem to be two possible answers. First, it's not owed to anyone, but is an undirected duty. Or maybe it's owed in some vague way to the needy. Apparently, then, it's the needy taking collectively who hold the correlative imperfect right, and the needy taking collectively who are wronged if it's not met. Either way, the analysis seems inadequate. It's individuals, not just this group, who are wronged when their need is not met. But suppose instead we take the fundamental moral fact to be that of an imperfect right. Then we can say that every person has a right to, say, adequate sustenance and care when sick or injured. But the right is imperfect because it's not clear who among us owes it to him, or how exactly the need is to be met. Who then holds the correlative imperfect duty? I think the parallel answer is that it's all of us, the members of the group taken collectively, who have a duty to ensure that everyone among us, gets help when he's in need. I'll come back to the question which group exactly this is. Now, I'm certainly not the first person to point out that assigning the duty of beneficence or charity collectively to a group explains some other intuitions that many of us have about this kind of duty. In particular, it explains the intuition that for each of us, there's something like a fair share of charitable contributions, a portion of the total need that she should be expected to meet, given her wealth and income. If others in the group don't give their fair share and you do, then not only those who remain in need, but you also are in a sense wronged by them. It also implies that the duty of each of us is not, at least in the first instance, to give enough to charity to support all of the unmet need that we possibly can. Instead, our most immediate individual duty is to try to organize the group in such a way that all of the unmet need will be met. Speaking a bit roughly, this means that taking political action to realize better conditions where possible may be just as good or better than trying to resolve the problem of unmet need through extensive charitable giving. So the idea that each of us has an imperfect right to aid should we come to need it makes much better sense than the idea that each of us has an imperfect duty to give aid to some unspecified people. It implies that if individuals perish in our midst for want of aid, those individuals have been wronged. The imperfection of the right rests in the fact that it's hard to pick out any particular individual who's responsible for the wrong and for fixing it. But it seems perfectly reasonable to say that society, or humanity taken collectively, has failed to uphold the rights of this needy person, and so has done wrong. Okay, now if we accept this, we're left with some questions. First of all, is there such a right? Does each of us have a right to assistance when in need? And if so, why? Second, who exactly, which collective, owes the correlative duty? And finally, how can a collective have a duty? Now, I'm going to start by saying something about that third question. For some entity to hold a duty, to be required to do something, that entity must be an agent. On most accounts of morality, and certainly on Kant's, it must be a rational agent, one who is capable of thinking and making decisions based on rational considerations. In particular, the rational agent must be capable of recognizing that it has duties and responding to that fact by doing them. How can a collective or a group of people have a duty on this account? Well, like many philosophers, I think there is no problem that groups of people can form collective agents in this way. Groups can think when their members can think, and when they can also talk and debate, which amounts to thinking together. And they can act, not just individually, but as a group, when they have a procedure for making decisions that makes those decisions count as the decisions of the group. Political states are collective agents in exactly that sense. A political state thinks through the thoughts of its legislators and makes its decisions by voting and passing laws. So it's possible for a group to hold a duty corresponding to a right. Now, of course, humanity, collectively speaking, is not already such an organized group. We have no mechanism for making decisions that makes them count as the decisions of humanity, collectively speaking. But Kant's argument shows us that a right can still exist provisionally against a group that as yet exists only in idea, so long as the ideal group is one to whose existence anyone who claims a right is committed. I say this because I believe that each of us does have a right to be helped when in need, an imperfect right that we hold against humanity collectively. I'm now going to explain why. And don't worry, we are going to get back to the question of animals, but I need this for my model first. We have to start with an account of our right to resources in general. Kant, as I mentioned earlier, thought that the function of rights is to protect the freedom of everyone. Among the rights he thought necessary for that is the right to claim things as our property. We can claim bits of the land and its products as our own, and his argument for this comes in steps. So first, you imagine you're living in the state of nature and you pick an apple off of a tree, an unowned tree. If anyone attempted to prevent you from doing this, he would have to interfere with your body. Grab you by the wrists, perhaps, and tear the apple from your hand. This would be inconsistent with your freedom. He would be using force to try to prevent you from acting, and you would therefore have the right to resist. It follows that you have a right to eat the apple, to make it your own by consuming it, simply because no one has a right to stop you. But that only shows that we can have a right to otherwise unowned things when they're in our physical possession. Kant thought that it must also be possible to have rights to objects even when they're not in our physical possession, that is, to own them, to have property. If it were not possible to do that, we could not make free and effective use of any natural resources that we cannot immediately consume or remain in physical contact with. The point is obvious when you think about the use of the land, the primary object of property in Kant's theory. I can't grow beans on a piece of land if you're free to rip them out and plant wheat there instead, whenever I'm not actually standing on the spot in dispute. So without property rights, we could not use natural resources without getting the permission of everyone who might possibly compete with us for their use. Kant thought this would be inconsistent with our freedom. Therefore, we must all agree that it's possible for an individual to claim ownership in the land and its products, a kind of ownership that goes beyond mere physical possession. As we saw earlier, however, as long as we remain in the state of nature, these claims are necessarily provisional. They cannot be made conclusive until we're brought together into a political state in which we can make laws and establish the exact contours of our rights together. Now, Kant took this argument to imply that those who live on adjacent territory have a duty to organize themselves into a political state. It's people who live in proximity who make claims of right against one another, and who therefore form the group against whom a right to property is held. But Kant also was keenly aware that ultimately all the territory on the earth is adjacent. The world is round, he liked to emphasize, and human technology conquers the mountains and the deserts and the sea, breaking down the barriers between us. So ultimately, a claim of right is a claim against everyone else who can claim rights, a claim at least against every other human being. And that means that ultimately, whenever we claim a right, we presuppose the organization of the whole human race into an organized body dedicated to upholding and protecting the rights of everyone. And we commit ourselves to membership in that group. It's this conception of rights that gives rise to the duties of aid. Now, in order to explain why, I want to return for a moment to the central question of this paper, the question of our relation to animals. I've explained why Kant thinks it must be possible for us to acquire rights in the land and its products, why we must be able to own property. Traditionally, philosophers have taken this kind of story also to show that we must be able to claim the other animals as property. But why exactly should that be? Well, in the traditional accounts of rights developed in the 17th and 18th centuries, especially in the theory of John Locke, it's perfectly clear what makes it possible for people to claim property in the other animals. It is a view derived from Genesis, to the effect that God gave the world and everything that's in it to humanity to hold in common, explicitly including the animals. Each of us can claim parts of this commonly held possession for his or her own private use, provided that he does so in a way that respects the fact that it's owned in common with others. Locke thought that when you took property out of the commons, you had to do so in a way that leaves as enough and as good for others. Kant, as we've already seen, thought that when you claim rights to property, you commit yourself to upholding the parallel rights of others. Both insisted that the assumption that human beings hold the world in common plays an essential role in their explanation of why we can have rights to property. The role of the assumption in both of their theories is to answer an obvious question. How could agreements among human beings to divide the earth up into objects of property be legitimate if we had no right to the earth in the first place? Now, the idea that God gave us the earth in common captures something that goes right to the heart of the moral outlook and that can be formulated in secular terms. It's the idea that others have just as good a claim on the resources of the world as we do, and it behooves us to limit our own claims with that in mind. More generally, and importantly, it's the idea that others have just as much of a right to a say about what should happen in the world, what the laws that govern it should be, as we do. Rather than grounding the idea of common ownership in revelation, Kant characterizes it as an idea that we presuppose whenever we claim our own rights. He describes it, somewhat surprisingly, as the right of every human being to be where he or she is. He says, all human beings are originally in a possession of land that is in conformity with right. That is, they have a right to be wherever nature or chance has placed them. The possession by all human beings on the earth which precedes any act of theirs that would establish rights is an original possession in common, the concept of which is not empirical. Original possession is rather a practically rational concept, which contains a priori the only principle in accordance with which people can rightly use a place on the earth. Now, when Kant says that every human being has a right to be where nature or chance has placed them, he means that every human being is part of the group that possesses the world in common. No one is doing any wrong just by being here, so anyone who tried to remove them would wrong them, and so everyone has a right to be here. As such, every human being must be regarded as one of the group whose rights you must acknowledge when you claim your own rights. You claim to be part of this group simply because you're here, and so must accord that standing to others who are here as well. Characterizing this most basic of all rights as a right to be where you are gives us a pleasingly literal way of interpreting the idea of moral standing. If you find yourself standing somewhere on the planet, then you're a being who can claim rights. Now, the idea that we own the world in common may sound fanciful, but I think there's a way of putting it that brings out an important point. Obviously, the world is not literally owned by anyone, individually or in common, until we human beings come along and set up our systems of property. So prior to any system of rights, there would be nothing exactly wrong in my establishing myself on some piece of land and defending it against all comers. That is, I wouldn't be violating anyone else's rights if I did so. But if I am to think of this act as establishing that I have a right against all comers, something that they have an obligation to respect, then more is needed. Or to put the same point in another way, if I am to conceive my relations with others in moral terms, in terms of right and wrong, and not merely in terms of power, then more is needed. For whenever I claim a right, as we've seen, I suppose that presuppose that humanity is an organized body dedicated to enforcing the rights of everyone. And if humanity did form such an organized body, then we would all have to agree through our legislative process about who had a right to what. And we would not all agree to a division of things that effectively denies someone the resources he needs in order to live. That would amount to kicking him off of the planet as if he had no right to be here. So my rights are by their very nature limited to a reasonable share of the Earth's resources. They're limited for the simple reason that others also have a right to a reasonable share. Now, that means that if property is now divided up in such a way that some of us can only live because of the charity of others, then there must be injustice in the situation, even if no one has done anything wrong to bring the injustice about. As Kant himself wrote, one may take a share in the general injustice even though one does nobody any wrong by civil laws and practices. So if we now do a kindness to an unfortunate, we have not made a free gift to him, but repaid him what we were helping to take away through the general injustice. For if none might appropriate more of this world's goods than his neighbor, there would be no rich folk, but also no poor. Thus, even acts of kindness are acts of duty and indebtedness arising from the rights of others. Kant's point here is that if some people are rich enough to give, and some so poor that they need to be given to, then there must already be injustice, even if it's not the result of any particular individual doing anything wrong. The world is not divided up into allotments of property the way it would be if humanity were actually organized into a group and deciding on this division together. So we should regard our charity not as an act of free beneficence, but as the correction of a wrong. In other places, Kant draws our attention especially to the fact that this kind of inequality makes the poor need the charity of the rich. And that matters to our discussion here because it shows how the question of freedom, and so of justice, is involved here. Plainly, if someone else is in a position to determine whether you are able, say, to eat or not, through discretionary acts of his own, then you are subject to that person's will. And that means that by Kant's criterion, you're not free. The traditional picture's distinction between a realm of justice concerned with the protection of freedom and a realm of beneficence concerned with the promotion of the good just doesn't hold up. Without rights to a fair share of the world's resources, the poor are a subject population. They're subject to the wills of the rich. Okay, following Kant, I've argued that the world's needy have an imperfect right to the aid that they need in order to survive in reasonable conditions. If they did not have that right, they would be subject to the wills of the rich. Correlative to this right is a duty of humanity, collectively speaking, to provide the needed assistance. The right is imperfect in the sense that it's unclear who exactly should provide the assistance and how it should come. And yet we have a duty to make this right perfect by organizing ourselves in such a way that the need will be met. And we have this duty because such an organization is presupposed by our own claims of right. So here we have a right with a particular structure, an imperfect right held as against humanity, collectively speaking. And that, I want to argue, is the kind of right that the other animals have against us. In Genesis, God gives the world to humanity, explicitly including the other animals as part of the gift. On that showing, we have collective power over them, as we do over any other piece of property. But suppose instead that we conceive our relations to the other animals in moral terms, that we conceive them as fellow creatures, not as objects to be owned. As I mentioned at the beginning of this lecture, most of us already do that to a limited extent because most of us agree that we have duties to the other animals. If we dismiss the category of imperfect duty and instead adopt the category of imperfect right, then we should think of the other animals, like ourselves, as having a right to be where they are, and therefore as among the rightful owners of the world. After all, if humanity's claim to a common ownership of the world is not grounded in revelation, it is grounded simply in the fact that we're here and are doing nothing wrong by being here. No one has the right to remove us. But if we don't assume their property, that's true of the other animals as well. Now, of course, there's a difference. I've argued that when a human being claims a right to his share of the world and its resources, he presupposes the idea of humanity considered as a collective agent, making a fair distribution of those resources to everyone who shares in the right to them. This is why a duty to assist those who are in need is presupposed in every claim of right that we make. More generally, as joint possessors of the world, we claim a right to participate in making the laws that will determine what will happen in the world, so far as that is up to human beings. But we can't form a collective agent that includes all of the animals who are affected by our laws, or if we did presuppose such an agent, it could only be an idea, The other animals cannot join with us in setting up a set of rules to govern the world that we share with them. They cannot join with us in shared deliberations about these matters or in making laws that inevitably affect their own lives and welfare. That is indeed why the other animals only have claims of right against us and not against each other. Humanity increasingly controls the planet, and the other animals, or rather some of the other animals, are also increasingly subject to our collective will. If we regard the other animals not merely as property, but as fellow creatures with a right to a share in the ownership of the world, then their subjection raises issues of justice, not merely of kindness. Animals, maybe not all of the insects, and certainly not all of the microscopic creatures that are everywhere around us, but animals of the sort we mostly agree are at stake in these discussions, are a subject population dominated by the collective will of the human species. And individual animals, as members of that subject population, are subject to the authority of human laws. If we collectively allow it, this means that they're subject to control by the arbitrary wills of individuals and organizations. This is, of course, particularly obvious of the animals in laboratories and factory farms, who are entirely at the mercy of the combined power of human technology and human law. And what the law does not forbid, it effectively protects. If our human laws say that people can keep animals in tiny cages for the whole of their lives, fatten them until they can no longer stand on their own legs, beat them when they put up with resistance, and slaughter them in inhumane ways, then that's what's going to happen to them. But if our laws say they must not be so treated, then there's a way to prevent such things without waiting on the kindness of individuals. If we regard ourselves as making laws not merely about the other animals, but on their behalf, because they are also among the rightful inhabitants of the world, then they have a right that we should make laws that are consistent with their good. The rich control the resources of the planet that we ought to share with the poor. So at least until we have greater justice, we owe them assistance as a matter of right. The more humanity becomes actually organized, and therefore actually able to take collective action, the more outrageous it becomes that we don't organize ourselves in such a way that this need is met. Humanity determines the fates of both individual people and individual animals through the laws that we collectively make, determining what individuals may do to one another. Unlike the power imbalance between the rich and the poor, the power imbalance between human beings and the other animals is not something that will ever go away. But to the extent that animals live under the authority of human laws, they're owed the protection of human laws. Animals have a right to that protection in the same way that the poor have a right to our aid. They have a right to that protection because they are a population effectively subjected to humanity's collective authority and control. Now, at the beginning of this paper, I mentioned some of the objections that people make to the idea of animal rights. And in conclusion, I'm just going to quickly sketch the responses to these worries that follow from the account that I've given. People object that rights involve the idea of reciprocity. I've argued that the kind of reciprocity inherent in the idea of a right is this, that rights can only be made conclusive together, so that when you claim a right, you commit yourself to the realization of the rights of others. This kind of reciprocity does not require that animals should be capable of respecting our rights in order to have rights against us. Instead, it implies that our own rights cannot be conclusive until we uphold the rights of the other animals. And in particular, we cannot move from a relation of authority, from a relation of mere power to a relation of legitimate authority until we respect their rights. Second, people object that rights protect a kind of liberty, the right to live in accordance with one's own values, that non-human animals couldn't possibly have. It's true that animal rights of the sort I've envisioned are concerned with their good, not with protecting their liberty and autonomy. Nevertheless, there is an issue about the freedom of animals, namely their freedom from human domination, from being subject to arbitrary wills. For like the poor, they are a subject population whose fate depends on our collective actions. Third, people object that it's absurd to suppose that animals have rights because then they would have rights against each other. The rights that I've attempted to defend in this paper are rights that animals hold against humanity collectively, rights that arise from our collective control of their world, and only apply really to our relations with those animals whose fate depends on our laws. They're not rights that animals hold against each other. As far as the impact of acknowledging that animal rights on human interests is concerned, obviously more detailed arguments are required. Beyond that, I can only say again what I said earlier. Yes, acknowledging the rights of animals would have serious impact on our interests. Genuine sacrifices would have to be made. My aim in this paper has not been to show that the idea of animal rights can be made uncontroversial. It has been to show that it's not unreasonable. We may suppose that animals have rights against humanity for protection against our arbitrary wills for the same reason that the needy have claims against humanity for a fair share of the world's resources. Because whenever we ourselves make individual claims of right, a commitment to dealing fairly with our fellow inhabitants of the planet is implicit in those claims. Thank you.